Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. While Vermont and Massachusetts are often ranked among the country's top states for solar energy, it's been a different story in New Hampshire. Large-scale solar projects have been slow to develop here for a variety of reasons, from state restrictions and how much energy can be sold onto the grid to local concerns about huge solar arrays eating up forest and farmland. But now, in some cases, new models of solar development are coming forward, aimed at assuaging those concerns by integrating principles of what's called smart solar siting. Today in The Exchange, the future of large-scale solar in New Hampshire. Let's get your thoughts. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. Joining us is Emily Cole, New England Climate and Agriculture Program Manager for the American Farmland Trust. She joins us by Skype. Hi, Emily. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us in studio, Dan Weeks, Director of Market Development for Revision Energy, a New Hampshire employee-owned solar company. And Dan, welcome back. Good to see you.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And also helping us out, Sam Evans-Brown, host of NHPR's podcast Outside In, our show about the natural world and how we use it. And Sam, thank you for your time as always.
I'm as always happy to be here.
So all of you, I want to start with you, Sam. What is the conversation right now in New Hampshire around large-scale solar projects? And how's that different from just a couple years ago?
Well, what's really changed is that since 2010, we've seen dramatic declines in the cost of what it takes to install solar, which for the first time has started to attract truly large-scale arrays to the Granite State, which previously, you know, if you look prior to 2010, had been limited to the parts of the country that had the best solar resource, the most sun shining on it. So down in the Southwest, Arizona, Nevada, where you saw the first truly large-scale megawatt and larger-scale solar installations. And those are now migrating their way to places that also have, you know, the characteristics of the New England market: high power prices, so you can get a good return on a utility-scale array, but also public policy supports, which you see in a lot of the New England states, which, as we'll talk about later in the show, is what's driving a lot of this development.
So it's become more economical. So when the price goes down, it's more interesting for companies to do this on a bigger scale.
And not only that, there have been some public policy changes, especially in southern New England, that are driving a lot of these large-scale arrays.
Well, I want to ask you definitely which states are really driving this, which companies are really driving this, Sam. But to you too, Emily, how do you hear this conversation right now about large-scale solar projects?
You know, I as American Farmland Trust, I think what we're hearing is concern over where it's located, concern over loss of farmland, especially when New England has a New England food vision, where we hope to make sure that we not only protect but increase our food production. And so there's a lot of land use conflict over, you know, farmland and the use of solar. They both have really great, important, you know, uses behind them. And the conversation is, you know, which one is more important? Which one do we need more? You know, there are sort of alternate ways to think about it that I think the conversation needs to shift to. And in the same frame, you know, core forests are incredibly important to ecosystems in New Hampshire. You know, the White Mountains are just, imagine that becoming a large solar field. That would make a lot of people probably blow steam out of their ears.
So as these projects possibly expand in New Hampshire and are already expanding around New England, you seem to be saying, Emily, whoa, let's inject the value of farmland and open space into this conversation.
Yes, exactly. Inject the value and, you know, not necessarily think it's an either or. I think that there's a way to incorporate both in a manner that can achieve open space, green space, farmland, forest, and get us moving towards renewable energy goals.
Well, and definitely hinting towards what we're going to talk about, smart solar siting, Emily. But Dan Weeks, how about you?
I think the real thing driving this conversation, Sam made great points about the 80% decline in the price of solar, the demand for it. I think two words really come to mind: climate crisis. I'm from an old New Hampshire family, a Republican family, at a time when Republicans really led on environmental conservation. And up north, where our old family farm is, where we've been for generations, I remember in the 80s and 90s as a kid, we'd see moose regularly. But I can't think of the last time that I or any member of our extended family has actually spotted one of them up in Lancaster. And of course, that's because New Hampshire Fish and Game tell us that with rising winter temperatures, 5.5 degrees, as this station reported a few weeks ago, in my lifetime alone, we've seen a proliferation of ticks, which attach themselves to the moose by the tens of thousands sometimes, and literally have killed off 70%+ of our young moose population, as you've talked about on this program. And that is a direct result of the climate damage we're doing, which is driving communities around the state, Concord right here where we're sitting today, and many others, to say we are committed to 100% clean energy, not decades from now, but by 2030 or 40 or 50. And that is creating a real impetus for us to figure out a way to site clean energy, solar, but also wind and hydro, in a way that can really meet those goals and address this climate crisis.
So what's changed for you, Dan, just in the past couple of years, it sounds like, is the immediacy of what we see with climate, the projections by the United Nations that we don't have much time and we need to move more quickly than we have been here in New Hampshire.
Absolutely. And we are, unfortunately, so far behind in this state. As you alluded to in the opening, we have yet to reach 1% solar penetration as a share of our electricity mix in New Hampshire. Just to the south of here in Mass, they're at 12%, even further along in Vermont. Maine is now moving forward by leaps and bounds with some significant changes in policy there. So we are lagging far behind, and we're leaving on the table thousands of good middle-class jobs, billions of dollars in local energy investment instead of sending billions out of state to import dirty energy sources. The opportunity is great, and we're unfortunately pretty far behind.
Well, and I was looking at some of those numbers that you referenced, Dan, yesterday, and, you know, the question keeps coming up, Sam Evans-Brown. Why is that? Vermont isn't any more sunny than New Hampshire. Massachusetts isn't any more sunny than New Hampshire. Why are they often ranked among the top 10 in terms of solar development?
Well, the answer there is public policy, right? Because we're all part of the same power market. So the price of electricity is largely the same in all of those different states, which means that really the dividing lines fall along public policy. And, you know, we'll dig in a little more, I think, to the different sizes of different arrays and the different incentives that drive the installation of. So, you know, there's residential scale. That's what you see on rooftops. That's, you know, maybe 10 to 30 panels on a roof, up to acres and acres of solar panels, which is what we refer to as utility scale. And all of those depend on different financial mechanisms in order to pay for themselves. And in the six different states of New England, the financial regimes that govern how quickly you can make your money back is different state by state. And Vermont, for instance, has very generous incentives for residential scale, and so we see quite a lot of it. Same thing with Massachusetts. Maine and New Hampshire have historically lagged, and so we see much less penetration at residential scale. When we talk about large scale, which is really what the show, I think, today is meant to focus on, things are a little more uniform across the region, though once again, it's southern New England that's driving things.
Interesting, and I hear you sort of wanting to talk about net metering, but it's complicated, and you and I have done a whole show on that topic. So just real quickly, since you mentioned public policy, Sam, and since the legislature is looking at net metering just this week, can you give us a brief description of what net metering policy is and why it's so important for this conversation today about large-scale solar?
Yeah, net metering was this really sort of kludged together workaround for how to sell solar power onto the grid that was developed in really the late 70s, early 80s. And basically what it was if you wanted to sell solar power onto the grid, the easy way to do it that they came up with was just make it so that your electric meter rolls backwards when the solar power is being exported from your property out onto the grid. And that means that you're selling power at a 1-to-1 ratio. The same market price that you buy electricity at, you're selling it at the same rate, which is a unique arrangement because if you're a power plant, you get wholesale rates. You don't get retail rates. And over the years, that policy of being able to roll your electric meter backwards has changed. We have better meters now, so you don't have to just roll it backwards. You can actually measure the amount that you're putting onto the grid and give it a different price. Today in New Hampshire, retail rates, if you're an Eversource customer, is like 18 cents for a kilowatt hour of electricity. If you're net metering, you get about 12 cents. Now, if you were a utility scale solar plant selling at market rates, you'd be getting more like 4 cents. So it's dramatically less money if you're selling onto the open market, and that is why residential scale, that's the real financial mechanism that's driving development at the residential scale, and utility scale on the other hand is driven by scale, right? If you can build 20 acres of solar panels, you can do it at a much cheaper price. So I was just looking up the numbers nationally. The average price for putting solar on your rooftop is about $2.70 per watt, versus utility scale is more like $1. So it's almost three times cheaper to install at utility scale versus residential scale.
So now we're talking real money.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is why these big projects are coming to New Hampshire.
Well, I'm guessing net metering will come up again in our conversation. And as I said, you and I, Sam, have done many shows on this topic before. But Emily, I want to bring you into also this round of questions about how the different New England states compare. I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have seen a big push in Maine recently with the changeover in the governor and the executive offices. And we've seen a real push and understanding that there really needs to be sort of a buckshot approach at trying to meet some of these solar goals. So it's not just about utility scale. It's not just about trying to get on the roof. It's really trying to find the best way to approach, several levels of solar, including finding ways to put it on the ground in a manner that isn't going to interfere with really Maine's love of their farmland and their forest land. In Massachusetts, they've got the SMART program, and there's been similar pushes to try to encourage things like dual use, which is raised solar panels so that you can actually continue, if it's farmland, you can continue farming underneath. If it's pasture, you can continue having your animals graze underneath. And so there is a pretty broad spectrum in terms of the value put on that, I'd say, state by state, with Massachusetts giving currently a 6-cent adder to dual use projects that are approved for their SMART program. And so I think that programs like that and incentives to try to be really creative and thoughtful about where you place the solar on the ground, because we need a significant swath of ground, New England wide. We can't put it all on our roofs and all on our brownfields. We just don't have enough. So if we can be really creative and really support some of this alternative siting, the smart siting like Massachusetts is trying to do and Maine is looking at, I think that other states like New Hampshire, excuse me, and other states like Rhode Island, which is also sort of behind in I'd say some of their policies and supporting this alternate and smart siting, I think that those types of interesting, supportive incentives are something to look at in each state in New England to see if we can improve where it goes to actually start meeting our total goals. Because, New Hampshire is, I think, in terms of like Acadia Center energy goals, it's number 4 in New England, so it's not really a large energy need. And so it is achievable without really large-scale loss of land. And it's also achievable if we really are creative with where we put it.
Well, I like the image of a cow grazing underneath a solar panel. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit more. But go ahead, Dan Weeks. I can see you want to jump in.
Yeah, just wanted to go back for a moment to the net metering discussion, which is a really important step toward the kinds of large-scale projects that are the main topic of this show. I think Sam well described the two kind of extremes. You have residential scale, a handful of panels on a roof, and then utility scale taking up many acres. What the state has been grappling with, and I spent much of the day yesterday at the State House going back over some familiar debates on net metering, is looking at an intermediate step. So Sam described residential sale, where that power is worth about 12 cents per kilowatt hour compared to a retail rate of about 18. And then utility scale, where it's actually more like 3 cents rather than 4 cents at average wholesale rates. In the middle, we have currently a provision for systems, smaller commercial systems, whether on rooftops or on ground, which get right about in between that retail, the 12 cent for residential and the 3 cent for utility scale, at about 8 cents per kilowatt hour, and that's the default supply rate only, none of the additional charges that the utility puts on. And the state has been grappling for some years now with whether we cap those roughly 8 cents per kilowatt hour projects on landfills or other relatively developed parts of a town, whether we cap them at 1 megawatt or allow them to go up to 5 megawatts.
Yeah, I remember that was the debate, that the governor wanted a cap of 1. A lot of solar advocates wanted to raise it to 5, saying this would really open the doors to more solar development here in New Hampshire. You're talking about kind of a middle ground, more solar development for these areas that are, you know, brownfields, sort of crummy leftover, you know, places that nobody uses anymore.
And it was a lot more than solar advocates arguing for it. You had a number of Republicans join virtually all the Democrats, and just a few votes short of an override for 2 years in a row now. A number of Republicans did turn, unfortunately, at the end. But needless to say, we've had dozens of communities push for putting those wasted lands, those landfills, those brownfields to good use, and to be able to get that kind of middle level of power without any cost shifting to other consumers, and thereby offset municipal load and add to the financial bottom line of towns that are pretty cash-strapped at this point.
Yeah, there are a lot of cities and towns that are really interested in doing that. And we'll talk a little bit later about some of the many projects that are going on or being proposed in communities around the state. But let's bring our listeners into this, all of you. Our phone number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And today we're talking about large-scale solar and the prospects for it here in the state. We've talked about net metering. We've talked about rooftop solar in other shows. So we're going to really focus on what these projects are that we're seeing in various communities, what some of the parameters are, what the concerns are. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, Theo is calling in from Francistown. Hi, Theo. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure.
And thanks to your guest. I really appreciated you guys talking about the impact on farms and farmland and the goal of food security. I wanted to point out, I grew up on a small family farm in southern New Hampshire in Wilton, and small family farms are really struggling. It's always hard to make that work economically, especially in New Hampshire and New England. So I think it's we should look at it less as a conflict and more as an opportunity. If farmers and farms can install solar arrays, especially in a way that doesn't interfere with their ability to farm, and we have a real opportunity for these farmers to earn additional revenue and to really make these farms work and keep those farms in place and not lose them to development.
Theo, it's great to hear from you. And Emily, that's for you. Go ahead.
That is such a great point and something that is so very important, Theo, to the American Farmland Trust. We absolutely see this as an opportunity because our small farms are struggling financially. You know, climate change is an issue. It's not just an issue, that we need to solve with clean energy. Our farms are struggling more and more because of the impacts of climate change, because of the threat of, you know, loss of production to pests, to temperature swings, to flooding. And so there is a real risk of losing that land to permanent development, to housing and commercial sites. When we install solar correctly on farmland, we can actually still have that as land. We can put it on places where you have unproductive fields. We can put it on marginal land. We can have it as dual use, but it is absolutely an opportunity if we smart it slightly, and will be less of a conflict if we do it that way.
Theo, thank you so much for calling in. And coming up, one environmentalist says she favors solar, but with the needs of the creatures of the natural world in mind. She wants that to be considered more strongly. Stay with us. We'll hear more. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, why large-scale solar has been slow to develop in New Hampshire. Let's hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call in 1-800-892-6477. With us now on the phone is Stephanie Scherr, director of Echo Action NH, a group of community leaders, environmental and climate activists promoting clean and renewable energy. And Stephanie, great to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Laura. I'm happy to be here.
What do you want New Hampshire cities and towns to think about as they consider large-scale solar projects? There are a lot of projects on the table around the state.
Thank you for asking. So one of the things that really got Fitzwilliam mobilized was the threat of the Kinder Morgan Ned pipeline, the 36-inch frack gas pipeline that would have gone through a lot of southern New Hampshire, including our town, through eminent domain. It was taking parts of farms and people's homes. It threatened aquifers, wetlands, even was going to go right next to schools. And so there were a lot of concerns about that. When that was withdrawn in 2016, we didn't stop being concerned because Liberty Utilities, who had been working with them, with Kinder Morgan, has continued to press for frack gas expansion throughout New Hampshire.
But what about solar, Stephanie?
Yeah, so that's what we're really excited about, is that we now have this new option. And the option has opened up solarized Monadnock, which had a lot more residential, and now this great new large solar array that's coming to Fitzwilliam. So the only real concerns the community has had is about wildlife, because there is fencing around it. There's some breaks where wildlife can get through, but we're concerned about that. People are concerned about noise. Even though we've been assured that noise isn't an issue, there have been some noise concerns with other, like, electrical projects. And the biggest question that I'm constantly asked is the energy for us? So Fitzwilliam residents are excited about this, but they want to know, is there the energy for us? And the answer is, yes, it is, because it's going into the grid and we all share the energy that does go into the grid. So it's a really nice opportunity for us to put that, you know, that clean energy into the grid, to be a part of that, and to help improve the RPS for New Hampshire.
The Renewable Portfolio Standard. What about the Fitzwilliam project's cutting of, I read, 100 acres of trees? One resident, Stephanie, said he was pretty upset about this. He loves going out into the woods to walk and hunt. What are your thoughts there?
Yes. So the person who owns the land actually cleared it. He logged all of the land before this project was approved.
It's
currently with the SEC. And so many residents felt that, although that's that person's right, that to clear so many acres of land before the project was approved was a concern, because with climate change, we want to sequester as much of that carbon as we can, which is in the trees. And so there's a loss there, which also, you know, can include erosion and habitat for wildlife. So there was a concern about that, but it's not something that we have control over at this time.
Well, and since you're talking about the Fitzwilliam project, Stephanie, I did want to let listeners know that we asked the developer of that project, NextEra, to participate in our conversation, but they said they were unable to do so. So I wanted to let listeners know we did give them the opportunity. I received an email, Stephanie, that I'd like to share with you from a listener, Jean, talking about this project. Jean says, it seems that we should work towards utilizing previously cleared surfaces such as residential and commercial rooftops, old landfills, abandoned lots, fields, and other open areas for solar energy before we start removing trees for massive solar farms such as the Chinook project. Jean says, are we forgetting the important role that trees play in reducing carbon in the atmosphere? Also, a project of this size can't help but alter the environment. With tree roots to absorb water, runoff patterns would change. Jean says, wildlife habitat will also shift, creating problems as deer and moose lose acres of shelter. She mentions foxes, coyotes, and other predators will encounter fenced obstacles around their hunting grounds, where rodents and other small prey were once kept in check. So this is really looking at this project with a broad ecosystem perspective. And Stephanie, I'd love to hear from you on that, your thoughts on what Jeannie contributes.
Yeah, thank you for asking. So just this week, we had a meeting in Fitzwilliam with the Site Evaluation Committee. And these are things that the community has bringing up. They're concerned about that wildlife habitat. After we were threatened by a pipeline, we did a full wetland assessment in Fitzwilliam, and we actually designated some of our wetlands as prime. And so we're definitely concerned about those same things. Yes, it would definitely be more effective if we could be able to put that on surfaces. We have a historic district in Fitzwilliam, as most of our towns do. Some towns do restrict whether or not you can put solar on historic homes, depending on how that town looks at what they all allow.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
But parking lots, and there are certainly enough stores in some of our main centers that are not having solar on the roof. There are a lot of places that we can be siting solar that we're not, and I think that what's happening, and this is not to pick on NextEra, but definitely they're looking for, you know, the easiest route. And if somebody is going to profit, they're going to have the ability to clear that land and make a profit. Sometimes that's an easier route than trying to get all that permitting through. And to use smaller sites, it'll be in segments rather than in one large array.
Well, one last question for you, Stephanie,
sure.
And I really appreciate your time. I know you sort of ducked out of a classroom to talk to us today.
No, they're actually right here listening in.
Oh, awesome. Okay. Well, it's always good to have students listening. That's wonderful. As somebody who cares about the environment deeply, as you clearly do, how do you weigh the clean energy benefits of solar versus some of these other items that we're talking about, disruptions to ecosystems and, you know, animal habitat and animal habits of hunting and mating and hibernating and so forth?
So I was at the State House the other day, and we were actually talking with several state reps and having this discussion. And I think from all ends, many people are concerned about these things. And we do know that whatever energy choice you choose, there's going to be some kind of a trade-off. There's going to be something that you're either going to have to give up, or there'll be some kind of an impact. And really, we're looking at the emissions mostly at this point. You know, any kind of a fossil fuel like gas is going to increase our emissions, and we don't want to do that. So we're not saying there's no impact from solar or even from hydro, but if we are going to move to renewable energy, we're going to have to make those choices. New Hampshire is looking at right now that a huge offshore wind farm, which would be a great benefit for us. There's just so much wind in the Gulf of Maine that we can benefit from, but we haven't done that yet. Unfortunately, Governor Sununu did approve a task force to look into that, which will bring New Hampshire up to where a lot of the other East Coast states are. They're already ahead of the process. So we know there's going to be trade-offs. So in the Gulf of Maine, we're going to be looking at, you know, migration routes and other wildlife impacts. And certainly fishermen and fisherwomen are going to be concerned about that as well.
Sure. Well, Stephanie, we'll talk to you again. Very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Stephanie Scher, director of Echo Action NH, a group of community leaders, environmental and climate activists promoting clean and renewable energy. And Emily Cole, Sam Evans Brown, Dan Weeks, lots to unpack there. And one of the biggest points that we talked about there with Stephanie, Sam, is the idea that we don't need to be cutting forests and farms and so forth. As our emailer Jean said, why can't we do this in brownfields and parking lots? Here in Concord, we have this giant mall that's half empty. And so, you know, couldn't we just put solar panels on the roof of the giant mall that people aren't shopping at anymore?
Yeah, well, so the answer to that question is that that is all happening, right? So there's a New Hampshire-based company called Granite Apollo that's developing brownfields. They're so-called brownfields to brightfields, I think is the term that I've seen thrown around, where you take land that is contaminated, and as part of the cleanup, you put solar on top of it. We are also seeing, as Dan can talk about to my left here in a moment, a lot of commercial scale, so these sort of medium-sized solar arrays that are put on these large flat roofs of shopping malls and athletic facilities at schools. And we are seeing now for the first time these utility scale, large scale projects that are put on green fields. So land that is privately owned. The private landowner says that they want to extract some sort of monetary value from it. And the choice that they make is to put up solar. And so the question is, are you going to disallow that land use? Because the reason it's happening is a financial one. We've talked about how utility scale, the bigger the project, the more your economy of scale, the cheaper the power price, which Governor Sununu in particular has prioritized as driving down rates. So if you do disallow that type of project, you're going to be pushing things towards a more expensive type of project, one that does rely on structures like net metering and state rebates and the like. So that is another type of trade-off. There's not just wildlife trade-offs. There's also financial ones as well.
Dan, what kind of siting is your company, Revision Energy, doing?
Yeah, so we're fundamentally a construction company, and I love getting out in the field. More than half of our 280 co-owners are electricians or apprentices becoming electricians building these systems. And I love just asking them every question I can think of about how we are designing a particularly a ground-mounted array in a way that really respects the natural environment and achieves the multiple goals that are being expressed here.
So you do put some arrays on the ground. You're not all rooftop on shopping
malls.
We do
indeed. We've done thousands of rooftop systems in New Hampshire, from small residential to a lot of public schools, soup kitchens, even resident-owned communities, mobile home communities. And then we've done a number of ground mounts for cities and towns, not these huge systems, although we're getting a lot of interest. I probably get a call a week from somebody who has a farm and wants to explore how they can be more sustainable, to the point that Theo raised when he called in, by allocating a portion of their land for solar, for instance. But when I'm on site and, you know, we're putting up a fence to surround a larger solar array, whenever we can, we avoid the fences by doing a meshing along the back of the panels so that the higher voltage electrical components are protected and nobody's going to get shocked. So we can often do without a fence at all. And then the animals are just free to move in and out. When we do have to put a fence on, we'll often reserve the bottom 6 inches or so. We won't bring that fence all the way to the ground. So most of the animals that are using that habitat can actually come in and out. I was recently up at Lebanon, where we did a mobile home community, a small ground mount, and it's a pollinator habitat around those solar panels. We've got an array of different wildflowers growing. Bees are busy doing their job, and we know that they've also been challenged by the climate damage that we've been doing, and they create such an important service to our food systems. And so we're finding ways to preserve pollinator habitats, to allow particularly smaller animals to move in and out freely. We know that the impervious surface of a solar array is actually a very tiny percentage of the land area that we're talking about, because the water does immediately go into the ground. And if we plant the right kinds of grasses, it will do the kind of ecosystem services that are so important. So we
really that's interesting. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. And just for listeners who might not know, impervious surface, ecosystem services, not quite sure what that is, Dan, just explain that in more layperson terms, what an impervious surface is and why that's so important to mitigate with these solar panels. Because some people say, hey, these things are flat and the water just rushes off and then it can rush into the stream or the lake and cause water contamination. But you're saying there are ways to do it smartly.
Yeah, I mean, a great example was, again, right here in Concord, where a project a couple of years ago was actually stopped by the local zoning process because it was treated as if it was a paved parking lot. Essentially, they took the surface area of all the panels and imagined that they were laid flat on the ground and that no water could get through. In reality, we space every row of solar about 20 to 25 feet apart. So most of the area in the solar footprint is actually just grass, whatever was there before. And when water does hit the panels, which are tempered glass, there's no contaminants that are mixing with the water. It simply runs off the panels and directly into the ground. And we make an effort every time to preserve ground conditions. We go through an extensive permitting process with New Hampshire DES, get alteration of terrain permits when necessary, to ensure that we're not creating erosion issues, that the water is doing just what it's supposed to do, very much the same thing that it did before.
Really interesting. And got an email from Marsha in Plymouth who says, thank you for the show. No one has mentioned putting solar projects on parking lots. I have seen them in the UK and a few US college campuses. Using what is essentially a blight on the landscape as a source of energy can mitigate some of the concerns you've been discussing. What might I be missing? Marsha, thank you for the email. And Emily, do you want to jump in on what we're talking about here? This kind of lines up with what you've been promoting, which is smart siting.
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. If we could put solar just on all of the rooftops, that is something that would be, you know, just wonderful, preserve all of the soil and all of the forest that we can. Unfortunately, that is an expensive route. There's a lot of infrastructure that might not actually be solar rooftop ready. And it is expensive to put solar, sometimes people also call it dual use, solar on the parking lots. You know, you get shade cover, you get a little bit cooler, you have solar. We would love for more of that to happen. It is expensive. It is one of the avenues that should continue to be explored. But what we are really looking at, and there's a partnership, AFT is working with Conservation Law Foundation, Vermont Law School, Vote Solar and Acadia Center, looking at what are some of the best practices we're seeing across New England for where the solar is going that we can really put together and then try to share with all of the states in our region to move towards this smart solar siting concept. It includes supporting rooftop where we can support rooftops, you know, trying to think about policies that incentivize and increase the payment on, you know, solar that is put in either on parking lots with, you know, an increased payment, or solar that is put in a manner in the ground that is more ecologically friendly or farm friendly, that does cost more for the developer. If we can find these policies that really support that type of siting, you know, best use of the land that's already disturbed first, you know, as much rooftop as we can get as well. And then if it has to go on our green space, which when you look at the numbers, it's going to have to go on green space, there's a way to site it that allows continued farm use, continued food production, continued, you know, ecosystem services, continued carbon sequestration, whether it's forest or farmland or park. There's a way to do it, either spacing or with best practices. You know, as Dan mentioned, you know, it's about ground cover. It's about avoiding compaction of the soil. When you have the solar in the ground, you can actually still have that land be a natural climate solution underneath the solar panel.
But you just can't
continue to sequester carbon under it.
You can't just slap it up quickly, though, and say, bing, bang, boom, you're done. You need to be a little bit more mindful and planful of how you work with the soil and the plants that provide those services that both you and Dan described. I'd like to take another call. This is Tim in Mount Vernon. Hi, Tim. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Tim. Go ahead.
So, gathered from listening to the conversation that we are surrounded, our neighboring states are developing solar power at far more larger scale than we are. And the fact that they're doing so tells me that obviously financially the development of solar power is something that's viable economically. So my question for the guest is, what is holding back the development of solar power in New Hampshire? Is it a political issue? Do we need to change our political leadership? Or is it the environmental concerns and the not in my backyard concerns, or a combination of the two? Because we can talk all day long about the aspects of solar power, but if we don't discuss why solar power is not being developed in our state, then it's kind of all a moot point.
Right. And that's, we started out asking that question, so let's tackle it again. I really appreciate you calling in, Tim.
Yeah, I'm going to sound a little bit like a broken record here, but the answer is really public policy and the finances, right? So if you are if you have a whole bunch of money and you're looking to put it somewhere, the question you are asking yourself as a manager of that money is, what is the return I'm going to get on this? And there might be institutions like universities and schools and towns that are okay with a 20-year payback period, but big financial folks are, you know, like people with a lot of money are looking for a faster payback than that. And so in the states where there are more aggressive public policy supports that make it so these projects can pay back faster, like in southern New England, where they're putting money on the table for this kind of stuff, that's where it's getting built.
Okay, well, I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. And after a break, we'll take more of your comments. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And in a moment, we'll talk with the developer of a large-scale project in Claremont, New Hampshire. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow, our weekly primary news roundup. That's Friday morning, live at 9. This hour, why New Hampshire has so little large-scale solar compared to our neighbors, especially in Vermont and Massachusetts. We've been hearing from you. Send us your questions and comments. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With us now on the line is Aaron Svedlow. He's president of North Light Energy, which has a proposed 10-megawatt solar array on vacant industrial property in Claremont. And Aaron, great to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So just describe where this project is going to be, because we've talked a lot this hour about siting and some of the concerns that, you know, just sort of mowing over grasslands or cutting down forests and putting in a large solar array is not maybe the first option that communities want to consider. So where is your project proposed to be?
So our project in Claremont will be on some property that is zoned industrial primarily and is adjacent to some existing industrial uses. It has been previously impacted by timber harvesting, fairly aggressive timber harvesting, and is slated for future development for other industrial uses.
So it's not a brownfield, like a contaminated site as designated by the EPA?
Yeah, no, it's not a brownfield. But we do have projects elsewhere in New England that we've built on previously impacted properties and aren't necessarily brownfields. So thinking about things like former sand and gravel mines, for example.
Oh, that's interesting. So what are the environmental considerations that your company is taking into account with this project that you have proposed in Claremont?
So we look at all the typical things that most developments look at, wetlands, impacts to erosion and sedimentation from the insulation of the facility, as well as wildlife. And, you know, when you think about solar as a land use, typically the impacts are quite a bit lower than some other alternative land uses. And our projects are temporary, so the Claremont facility will need to be removed after its useful life.
Oh, that's interesting. Temporary. So how temporary is temporary?
Well, temporary is temporary in terms of about 20, 25 years, potentially a little bit longer. But compare that to commercial and residential development, which is usually not temporary at all.
You know, we've done a lot of shows over the years, Aaron, on alternative energy, you know, hydro and wind and solar. And I have heard from some people who work for these companies who say when it comes to alternative energy, New Hampshire is tough. The siting is tough. There's often community opposition. As somebody who works around New England, I'm just curious what your thoughts are about the political or cultural climate for alternative energy projects here in the Granite State.
Sure. Every state's a little bit different, and the regulatory process really drives how easy or difficult a project is and ultimately the viability of that project. You know, New Hampshire is a state with strong local control, and that means that zoning and ordinances vary town by town. So you may have a favorable climate in one town, and it may be less favorable elsewhere. There is a threshold at which you trigger a state regulatory review, which can provide some more consistency. I was just going to say, we've had a lot of positive responses to our solar project, especially if they're sited properly. You know, we can do a lot of things to screen the facility. Visual impact is usually one of the biggest complaints we have with our facilities. So screening is important.
Screening. Now, what does that mean, Aaron?
Landscaping, typically.
I see.
We try not to do big fences, but we can do some nice landscaping with native plants.
We started out talking about why New Hampshire seems to be slower than its neighboring states in New England when it comes to large-scale solar. We just touched on it again. We got a caller who wanted to really dig into that. What do you think, Aaron, as somebody who works in this field, about why New Hampshire might be sort of behind the eight ball on this?
State policy is important. So if you look at the renewable industry in other New England states, it's driven largely by state policy. And that's changing a little bit because energy prices are much more competitive with renewables now. But if you look at the solar industry in Maine, it's really exploded in the last year and a half because of some progressive state policies that were enacted by Governor Mills primarily.
All right, Aaron, we will let you go. We'll keep track of that project in Claremont. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks for your time. Have a good day.
That's Aaron Svedlow, president of Northlight Energy, which, as we heard, has a proposal for a 10 megawatt solar array on vacant industrial property in Claremont. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you from Northampton, Bill is calling in. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. Just a quick question. We actually looked into putting solar rooftop on our house about a year ago, actually with Revision Energy. They were seemed to be the best in the field at the time. It ended up not really being being marginally cost effective. But when I asked about ground amounts, because we have a significant portion of our property is in current use, about 12 acres, of which about 4 is a field actually. When I did my unofficial research, it looked like it would be not possible without taking my land out of current use. And then there was also the wetlands question, where we have quite a bit of wetlands on our property as well, which even further eroded that usable line, I guess. Is there any consideration being looked into for how that would work with solar, where it's not really an invasive physical plant installation? I mean, I would love to put some panels out, but I just can't take our property that our current use to do it.
Wow. Bill, thank you for calling. Emily, I'm going to throw that to you. And just to let listeners know, current use is a separate form of taxation or a different type of taxation for open space, with the goal of keeping, open space open, forests, farmlands, and so forth. This is a very interesting question that Bill asks. Emily, can you shed any light on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Current use is a really important topic when we're thinking about farmers or landowners who are getting these, different tax assessments because of how their land is developed. And so if we think about putting solar on a field, there are ways where the open space or the farmland can still be actively open space or actively farmed. And so there should be consideration, and there would have to be policy change, but there should be consideration for allowing that to remain in its current use state. The other option is, because this is a beneficial, ultimately, right, we're putting solar, we're going to work towards renewable energy, that perhaps there's another option where, if it's just a standard array, maybe there's no penalty for taking it out of current use. You don't have to pay the back taxes, which is sometimes what you need to do, and it would just be a change of status without the penalty. There are options to make solar more financially reasonable for the landowners, as long as we are thinking about, how is the solar going into the land? Are we protecting the land? Are we doing this in a way that, still achieves both? We still have our land, and we're getting those solar megawatts that we really need.
Well, Bill, it's really interesting, and it's something I had not thought about, how, as a landowner, your current use status might be affected by putting in a solar array. Dan Weeks, Carolyn Lime, has a similar question. She says, does the Upper Valley Land Trust, or any land trust, allow solar or wind farms on conservation land? So again, there's this question of, we've got this open space, it's conservation land, or it's land enrolled in current use. If we put solar energy panels on it, does that change it so much that we lose that status? So thank you, Carol, for the email, and Bill for the call.
These are challenges, and I do want to thank Bill for taking a hard look at rooftop solar. We're always honored when we can get out and provide designs. And if you've got some tree shading or the roof isn't quite south-facing, it can be difficult financially, particularly in New Hampshire, less so in other states.
But these because of the incentives that those states provide.
Right, right. And I would hasten to add, we do collectively spend over $20 billion in tax incentives for fossil fuel generation. We spend much less on solar and other clean energy incentives in this country. One way in which communities are trying to address this, and actually the state has been contemplating a solar bill of rights, which other states like California that have been leaders for years in this transition have adopted. And this would deal with, for instance, historic districts or housing complexes where a homeowner association may have a couple of members who don't want to see any solar panels on that roof. They're not used to it. Where it would say, unless it's doing really demonstrable harm to the community, you do have a right to put it on your roof. When it comes to conservation lands, we have not yet found a case where land under conservation easement can be opened up for solar. Although it's part of a set of discussions that are happening around, should solar be treated like another shopping mall when we know its environmental impact is nothing like a shopping model. But I would hasten to add that we don't need to open up our conservation lands. We need only a fraction of 1% of our land in New Hampshire to meet all of our energy needs with solar. And it's never going to be all solar. We've got plenty of wind potential, offshore wind as well. We've got hydro already delivering power to the grid. So we could get to 100% renewable. Imagine that future, all of our energy dollars staying in state, thousands of good middle-class jobs here in New Hampshire to meet those needs with just a fraction of 1% of our land.
Emily sent us an email. She says, the Conval School Board voted unanimously this week to support a solar project at our high school after 2 years of advocacy from local residents. Supporters started the project to raise local awareness and take action towards solving the climate crisis. But in addition, Emily says, the solar project also met the school board's requirements that it has no cost to taxpayers and will return savings over the 25-year life of the project. Emily says the Conval Solar Project faced early resistance from some board members, and so the unanimous vote was a welcome first goal achieved to raise awareness at the community and school board level and also engage students to advocate for their future. And Sam, I've got a list of some of the proposals, the large-scale solar projects on the table here in New Hampshire, some approved, some not. And there are some that are not, you know, companies that are going to build a large array in a field or on a rooftop. They're school districts and municipal centers and so forth. So talk about the local government interest in this and activity there.
Yeah, well, this has actually been another of the major innovations that has led to an explosion in the amount of solar that's being rolled out. And it was a financial innovation, which is there have been models that have been created that allow, you know, sort of zero money down third-party ownership. Someone else owns the panel. You're just leasing your roof space, for instance.
Solar City used to have that model here in New Hampshire, but I think
before they pulled out.
They left town, yeah.
And usually that means that the people who are the hosts of the panels, because they're not the owners in that case, are actually capturing a little bit less of the value, and more of the revenue from the generation of the power is going to the company that owns them. But it can be a useful model when it comes to schools or cities that aren't able to claim the federal tax credit that is one of the large drivers of one of the big subsidies that allows solar to be installed. So that financial model has been a big part of why solar, especially these medium-sized arrays that go in schools and towns have started to roll out. And this really highlights the broad diversity of the different types of gymnastics that users have had to go through in order to make solar work for them. And a really interesting case is Fidelity Insurance here in New Hampshire that has a 3-megawatt array, which is I think by any definition a utility scale array, would power thousands of individual homes. But because there is enough electricity demand from their facility, it's entirely behind the meter. So they don't have to deal with any of the complicated financial business. They're just using it to offset electricity usage at their site. And so that means that you know, every watt is sort of claiming the maximum value on the market, which they're able to do because they're a large user of power. And then you have the complicated arrangement that is net metering and sort of the full spectrum of these different ways that people finance these projects.
That's interesting. So Fidelity is a large financial investment firm, right, based in Southern New Hampshire,
and so
Merrimack, I think, is
in Merrimack. I'm actually not sure if that's their headquarters.
Probably is.
But
they've just said, let's put solar panels on our roof. Let's power ourselves, basically.
It's actually in a field. They actually did have to clear some trees in order to put it. They put up a fence. But it didn't, you know, it didn't rely on net metering, and it didn't rely on, a third-party ownership model. It was able to just sort of be, offsetting their other usage.
Dan, you have some projects that are these municipal projects, right, that sort of occupy this middle ground that Sam described. So go ahead.
Yeah, and we really see that as the opportunity for New Hampshire to take several big steps in the coming years, even as these large utility scale projects will take years to develop. To the example that was raised by Michelle, we've been really excited to have a community of impact investors, so folks who have the ability to put up capital and are willing to make well below market returns to really see these kinds of solar energy endowments deployed to schools, to nonprofits, soup kitchens, all sorts of institutions in our communities. And they share our climate mission. So they've come together through something called Revision Solar Impact Partners, families here in New Hampshire that are financing projects like the Conval High School one dozens of other schools and nonprofits and municipalities. And because New Hampshire doesn't have really any state incentives, it's been necessary to find these mission-aligned investors to put up the capital. And as Sam noted, there's no upfront cost to the host. They get below grid, below current cost electricity from their roof, green power from their roof instead of brown power from the grid. They realize immediate savings, and then they can buy it out after just 5 years and generate free power for decades more to come.
Last question for you, I think, Emily. What are you going to be looking for in this new year? You know, it's not even February yet, still January. In terms of what the legislature does here in New Hampshire, or activity by individual towns or private entities, what are you going to be keeping track of, Emily?
I think we're looking for a few things. We're looking for actually how some of the local conservation districts and land trusts are approaching the smaller size arrays that farmers and conservation landowners are trying to cite, because those entities are so conservation-minded that if they can find a way to feel comfortable with solar, then they've probably found something that we can look to for other examples across the state. And same thing with municipalities that are finding a way to balance protecting land and, you know, building renewable energy for our future. We're going to look to the smaller towns and smaller organizations that have found these solutions and try to share those broader across the state.
Some of the solutions that we've talked at the local level, we've talked about those today. Emily, thank you very much for being with us. It was good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
That's Emily Cole, New England Climate and Agriculture Program Manager for the American Farmland Trust. Sam Evans-Brown, thank you for helping us out. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sam Evans-Brown, host of NHPR's podcast, Outside In. And Dan Weeks, good to see you. Thank you for being here as well.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
Dan Weeks, Director of Market Development for Revision Energy, a New Hampshire employee-owned solar company. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.